We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's January 27th, 2022, as we record a new show. David Ortiz of the Boston Red Sox, as expected, was the only player to be voted into baseball's Hall of Fame. That is certainly newsworthy, as is seeing both Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens get shut out by the writers. Their Hall of Fame fates now lie in the upcoming committee's hands to decide if or when both get in. But what grabbed headlines this week in baseball is, of course, the ongoing Major League Baseball collective bargaining agreement talks. Both parties met face-to-face in Manhattan to negotiate core economics of a new CBA. There's no deal in place, but we did get insight that the Major League Baseball Players Association might be focusing more on getting younger players paid with an increase in minimum salary. Major League Baseball countered the MLBPA's offer with a 5% raise, which doesn't cover inflation. Shockingly, there's still no deal. I have been wondering for a bit how these negotiations are being covered. We, fans, content creators, other media outlets, are getting this information often second or third hand. What really goes on in collective bargaining talks? Well, it so happens that someone with that knowledge has been sharing it on Twitter. His name is Eugene Friedman, and he's the counsel to the president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I find his discourse refreshing when it comes to trying to figure out what's happening between the league and the Players Association, and he is kind enough to join us now on this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Eugene, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Josh. I appreciate the opportunity.
So for our listeners and followers who may not be familiar with you, can you share your background, especially with your work with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association?
Sure. So I'm a labor lawyer, a union side labor lawyer. Before I came to NATCA, I negotiated a couple of collective bargaining agreements as a member. So I was a member of the union, as well as being a lawyer. And I was on those bargaining committees, negotiated the CBAs on my own behalf with my fellow members, and then came to NATCA about 17 years ago. And for NATCA, I've negotiated four CBAs with the FAA, an additional, I think, seven or eight extension agreements for those CBAs, three with our staff union representing management on the side of the employer, which is an interesting hat to wear as a union side labor lawyer. And one, we also represent federal contract towers, which are towers that are contracted out by the FAA to be operated by private sector tower operators. And in one of those, about a decade ago, we reached impasse and I was asked to step in and take over the negotiations. And we broke impasse and reached agreement. So I don't know how many CBAs that is total, probably about 10 term CBAs that I've negotiated.
All right. So you got a great deal of experience with what's going on, especially a collective bargaining agreement and the negotiations. So I want to start with the media depiction of the talks between the league and the Players Association. In your opinion, are the national outlets doing a good job relaying what's happening between the two parties and conveying to fans on the talks between the league and the Players Association?
I think it really varies who is delivering the message. I would say that there are some national media that do a really good job of reporting and advising people about, you know, what's going on. I think that a lot of the times, because the terms of art are very specific in labor law and collective bargaining, they sometimes use, I guess you'd say, you know, common parlance. And when they do that, they sometimes run into trouble. One of those words is impasse. Impasse means that the parties have basically reached the end of bargaining. They can't reach agreement. And when impasse is reached, it basically gives management, particularly management, specific tools that it may use to unilaterally implement their last best offer. That's not something that has happened in the negotiations during 2020 to reopen bargaining. It didn't happen even in the 1994-95 strike. National Labor Relations Board, as well as the district court where Judge Sotomayor, now Justice Sotomayor, heard the case, she found that the parties were not at impasse. And so unilateral implementation was not available to management. And so to say that the parties are at impasse just because they've not yet reached agreement is painting a false picture. The parties are still in disagreement. They're still working through the issues and they're still negotiating. So that is by definition not impasse. Another term that's been used that's been used incorrectly is concessions. In collective bargaining, concessions generally means that the union had something already in a previous agreement and it's giving it up in order to protect some other right that they're interested in. Whether it's management says, hey, if you don't take a 20% pay cut, we're going to move the plant to Mexico. That would be a concession. If you make a proposal for something new and you withdraw that proposal, all you've done is withdrawn a bad proposal or a proposal that was unachievable. You haven't made a concession. And so, you know, when the union withdrew its proposal to reduce the time to achieve free agency from 6 years to 5 years, when it withdrew that, it didn't make a concession. It just withdrew a proposal. The same was when management withdrew its proposal to start arbitration at 3 years instead of the current super two status. That's not a concession. They just withdrew their proposal. And so, you know, those terms of art are critical in capturing what's actually going on between the parties. And, you know, I would hope that, you know, my tweeting about the ongoing negotiations can help educate not just the public, but also the media so that they can phrase things in a more appropriate way.
So Rob Manfred, in his letter to baseball fans on December 2nd, 2021, he wrote, quote, simply put, we believe that an offseason lockout is the best mechanism to protect the 2022 season, end quote. Then the league didn't meet with the Players Association for 42 days after that letter was published and 43 days after the lockout was official on December 1st, 2021. Is that a normal collective bargaining tactic taken by Major League Baseball to have a lockout and then proceed not to talk to the other party for 40 plus days?
So, yeah, that was a really interesting letter, and it contained a lot of falsehoods, both misrepresenting the status of bargaining and misrepresenting the state of the law in the United States. So in the letter, the commissioner said, you know, this is just part of the negotiating process. Well, it's not really part of the process. It's a management tactic Management is free to do it, but it's a unilateral right of management. It is not required. It's actually uncommon for a lockout to occur. In baseball in particular, there hasn't been a lockout since the 80s. That was a decision. It was a decision that was not made by both sides. And a lot of the media seems to place blame on both sides, whether they're trying to be objective or something else more nefarious is behind it. I don't know. But when they say, you know, both sides are responsible for this, that's not true. This was a unilateral action. It was not required. Stating that this is, you know, both sides are responsible for the lockout is not true. And I think it's important to note that management can end the lockout at any point. It's a completely unilateral action, and only they are responsible for it. Additionally, you know, the letter said that the commissioner hoped that this would, move the parties towards resolution, that it would spur negotiations. And then his side took a 42-day Christmas vacation. Now, I assume for part of that time they were working, you know, on their own to develop their most recent proposal. But when the ball is in your court and you say you want to move the process fast, you don't then take 40 or more days off. You know, in the way we negotiate normally, we work for 2 weeks together. That doesn't mean we're in the room together all the time, but you know, we're meeting face-to-face part of each day, and we're working on proposals, counter proposals, and reviewing the other side's proposals, you know, in our caucus. And then we take a week or two off between sessions, regroup, go back to our other, you know, activities and responsibilities, and then we get back together for another 2 weeks. So we're usually like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And that sets a pretty good pace of negotiations. In some negotiations I've done straight through, where we meet every day until we have an agreement. And that's grueling because you don't get a break. You don't have a chance to regroup and refresh. In one of those instances, we were working with professional mediators to help us reach agreement. So, you know, that moved the process faster. But, you know, it is a complicated process. I think fans sometimes expect, and the media will sometimes couch it as, why don't you guys just get in a room and get a deal? Mm-hmm. It's not that simple. There's a lot of tentacles to a lot of these proposals. Some of them have unforeseen consequences. You know, I don't think the union saw the effect of the draft pick compensation in the last agreement. And it had obviously devastating effect on free agency for players over 30 who were not at, you know, the highest level of the game. So, you know, every time they enter negotiations, they have to try to model these things out. They can't just sit in the room and say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's move on to the next topic. They have to kind of work through it, work in their caucus. Sometimes those caucus negotiations with your own side are the hardest ones because you've got to get everybody in consensus that it's a good proposal to make. So yeah, it's not exactly an easy situation, and it won't come so fast. But I think right now, one of the positive aspects is that the parties are talking the same language. Their proposals are on the same topics. They're not seeking major revisions. And so, yes, they're apart on a lot of economic issues, but they're not apart on philosophical issues, which is, I think, a key aspect to reaching an agreement.
So from the owner's perspective, the Colorado Rockies owner, chairman, Dick Manfort, he's one of the lead representatives for the owner subcommittee with these talks. And during a recent meeting with the Players Association, he tried to plead his case that the teams are once again not making that much money, and such expenses like ballpark security are rising, which are causing complications for the owners. Is Manfort helping the case to a new deal here, or is he possibly opening up a wound for the league itself during these negotiations with the Players Association, in which the owners really never open up their books, with the exception of the Blue Jays, because they're owned publicly, and the Atlanta Braves?
Yeah, so that's something that is kind of, I guess, what you might call labor law 101. When you're at the table as management, you never say, we can't afford something. We can't afford your proposal, because that does trigger different responsibilities. Now, we don't know exactly what he said. We only know what was reported. But in those reports, he did say we can't afford, some owners can't afford their teams. And that may have made a new avenue for the Players Association to pursue. Now, obviously, the context matters, whether it actually would have triggered something. But that's something that you tell your management team on day one. Don't say we can't afford it. Say we don't agree with it. Say it's cost prohibitive. We think that this is just isn't a reasonable proposal.
We'll be right back with more with Eugene Friedman and the conversations regarding the Major League Baseball CBA after a quick word from our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
So the perceived big economic sticking point, I say perceived based on the most recent reports from the Players Association side, as you mentioned, they withdrew the 6 years to free agency path and not going right now.
5 years.
Yeah, to 5 years or age-based system.
Right.
The two sides, there's a pretty significant difference when it comes to this bonus pool. If a player that hasn't reached 3 years yet wins Rookie of the Year, MVP, Cy Young, the association wants $105 million for that bonus pool to divvy out. The league only wants to offer $10 million. So that's a gigantic difference. But the minimum salary, the league is offering a 5% raise, so $615,000 minimum for the first year. The league wants $750,000. For fans that watch this sport, they look at the league and say, this is a $10 plus billion industry. And if the Players Association wants $750,000 and the league only wants to pay $615,000, are these two numbers close enough that a deal is coming together? Or could this, you know, seemingly small gap, we're just talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for millionaires and billionaires, could be a sticking point in negotiations that causes this lockout to extend?
I think we don't need, and it's important not to focus specifically on the most recent negotiations and what was discussed in that one meeting. So yes, this bonus pool is part of the wide range of issues that are still outstanding between the parties. And it was what they discussed at the last meeting between the parties on Tuesday. But it is only one aspect. So my understanding is the Players Association had a number of key asks. One was related to whether or not they were going to increase the ability to for employees or players to make money sooner. So part of that is the minimum. Part of that is how much they make during their pre-arbitration years. Part of that is when they're eligible for arbitration. And the parties have not agreed on any of those things. And one of those potential fixes was, you know, how soon players might be eligible for free agency. You know, that's all still outstanding other than when they'll be eligible for free agency. And the players have, as you noted, withdrawn their proposal. So that seems to be wrapped up. But there are other issues as well, which is tanking. And the Players Association is very much wanting to create more competitive balance. I know that the competitive balance tax is named for competitive balance, but when the Pirates received $58 million in shared revenue for national TV this year, which is a 30% increase, as reported by Maury Brown of Forbes, you know, you're talking about a significant amount of shared revenue right there. Then they have a $50 million local TV package. Then they have other shared revenue, some from the competitive balance tax, some from other commissioner-controlled funds, such as Major League Baseball, Advanced Media, and things like that for streaming and so forth. You know, all of those things go in before a single ticket is sold. So you're talking about revenues of upwards of $120 million for the Pirates, a low revenue franchise. And then on top of that, you're adding ticket sales and merchandise and things like that. So, you know, when the Pirates then spend $55 million on player salaries, yes, they have other operations costs. Yes, they have a variety of minor league teams that they're funding and, you know, academies in Latin America and things like that. But they're not spending $170 million or $180 million on those things. And I'm not even counting all revenue, right? I'm counting the revenue that I know about as a complete outsider. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a $120 million difference. And the Pirates aren't unique. They're just an example because they're considered a woeful franchise. Well, part of their woes are they keep trading with the Rays and keep getting worse every time they do it. But, you know, the thought is these teams are not broke. These teams can afford more. And to spread out so much revenue among the teams that are just choosing not to compete, whether they're rebuilding like the Orioles on an extended rebuild, or they're not rebuilding at all like the Pirates, they're just losing year after year. You know, those things affect the overall expenditure on players, and the union knows that. So it wants to keep teams from keeping all that revenue and not spending it. One way to do that is to reduce the amount of revenue that's shared, and so They've looked at that. There are discussions about changing the draft so that teams aren't, you know, rewarded with better draft picks and a variety of other things. So those are the things on the Players Association side. But let's not forget management is also asking for some major things in these negotiations. The competitive balance tax expired at the end of the last regular season. So in order to have a competitive balance tax this year, and in future years, it has to be negotiated again. The players are obviously amenable to that. They've made proposals already creating or recreating a competitive balance tax. The players have also agreed in concept to the idea of expanded playoffs, which is a huge ask for management. They asked for it back in 2020. It was agreed to as a one-time only to make up for lost revenue during the no fans games, but it was not provided for 2021 because, like the competitive balance tax, the Players Association wanted to go into these negotiations with a major chip available to them to trade for something else they wanted. And in this case, that revenue generated by TV especially for these additional playoff games will be huge. And the players want a share of that. And whether that's a direct share, like they proposed back in 2020, or it's a share based on, you know, increased salaries overall, increased salaries earlier in players' careers, something like that, you know, that's what they're looking for. But in concept, they haven't opposed it. So management knows that its two major goals are going to be achieved. The only question is, what are they going to agree to in exchange to meet those two major goals? You know, and the other thing the Players Association has asked for a number of cycles now is a universal DH. I think management can't treat that as a traded item now. Management wants pitchers not to get hurt swinging the bat and running the bases. It benefits both parties. The fact that it hasn't been agreed to is a shame. That shows that management is not yet serious about this, because that's an issue that can be resolved immediately without any question. And it may have some minor costs associated with it, but it may also save money on the back end for injured pitchers. So that's the kind of thing that would show that the parties are really moving towards agreement once they knock that off the table, mm-hmm. because that's a shared interest.
If the league drags its feet more, because we're not quite sure when they're supposed to meet again for another core economics talk, and this gets dragged into March and there is no CBA and Major League Baseball still has the lockout enforced, is there anything legally that the Players Association can do to challenge the lockout by Major League Baseball?
No, because this is, as I said, a tactic, and it's a tactic under the law that's provided. It's one of the presumed options for economic warfare. You know, on the player side, they can engage in a strike. Management side can engage in a lockout, unless the lockout is for an illegal reason. And in this case, it's not. You know, there's really nothing legally that could challenge it. The players can win the PR battle. We want to go back. But, you know, as I said, with the media saying, you know, both sides are responsible, it may not be worth that PR battle. The other piece of it, I guess, is that, you know, losing spring training games, mm-hmm. It's a cliff. And I've explained it this way. You've got the coyote chasing after the roadrunner. If he catches the roadrunner, they have a deal. He's chasing after him. He's trying to make the deal. He's running at this cliff at, you know, 100 miles an hour. Well, when he gets to the cliff, it's not a fall splat on, you know, from 800 feet up. He's running at this cliff and he's falling 5 feet. He's stumbling and he's keep right on running, chasing that deal. And when he gets to the regular season, he's got another cliff and he falls, you know, maybe 10 feet and he doesn't go splat. He keeps right on running because they have no other choice. They have to make an agreement. It's just who has the levers against the other side and who can use that leverage effectively to get the agreement that they want. Now, a lot of these things are mutual interests, you know, and there's a mutual interest in playing games. The players on opening day is when they start to accrue their salaries. They don't receive money during spring training. So I don't think they're that concerned about missing spring training games other than the preparedness and the health risk, you know, all of those intangibles. But in terms of tangibles, the loss of income, they won't experience that until opening day. Management starts to experience a loss of income when they don't have spring training games. They start to receive pressure from those municipalities that aren't getting tax receipts. You know, they start hearing it from fans in Florida and Arizona. How come we're not seeing these games? And then starting opening day, they start losing revenue from other things. Now, some of them may not lose revenue for their local TV, but they'll lose ticket receipts. They'll lose merchandise sales. They'll lose those things. Obviously, their big ticket is TV money, national TV money. And when they lose national TV money, that pressure comes more in August, September, and October. And so from that perspective, this is a defensive lockout. They didn't want to give the union the lever of power there to strike in August and put at risk the playoff money that they had coming. Ultimately, the players could decide, we're not giving in now, and it gets to August anyway. And then who's locking whom out at that point? Does management say, yeah, we want you back under the existing CBA because that's what they would have. And they wouldn't have a competitive balance tax. So Steve Cohen, who, you know, signed all those players right leading up to the lockout and has a potential payroll significantly more than $210 million this year, and also way more than, I think, $214 million, which is what management offered last, which is a ridiculously low increase. He's not going to have a competitive balance tax this year if they restore the status quo. And labor law preserves the status quo. So the parties, in the absence of an agreement, continue to operate under their last existing CBA. And if the lockout weren't in place, the existing CBA would be in place. And, you know, from that perspective, who are they locking out? I think they're locking out Steve Cohen, the Dodgers, and perhaps a handful of other teams that might have blown through the prior competitive balance caps threshold.
I've never really thought of it that way. Finally, based on your experience and what you're seeing here, there's a lot of people who think that until they get closer to a deadline, like no deal gets done until there's some type of deadline that you're coming up against. And people have used the opening of spring training as a deadline. There are many that use opening day as a deadline. Do you think that we as fans and the media and other content creators, et cetera, are in a serious threat of having opening day, which is scheduled to be in late March, pushed back into April or even in May?
I would say this thing. Baseball does not have a time clock. Same with collective bargaining. There's really no deadline to reach a deal. The parties have the same obligation, the same duty to bargain in good faith until they reach an agreement, whether they're meeting, whether they're not meeting, whether they are preventing work from being accomplished, or they are on strike, or they are in an off season when they're not working. They have the exact same duty. So the party, and they can't divorce each other. I mean, this is a situation where management can't say, we don't want the union and we're going to do it without them. And the union can't say, we don't like management, we're going to do it without them. They need each other. They're required to meet. They're required to bargain. So I think opening day, as I said, is a leverage point. I don't think it is a drop dead deadline. And, you know, an expectation that the clock's going to run out, or an expectation that, you know, bargaining is going too slowly. Yeah, when you don't meet for 42 days, it's going too slowly. But when you meet for two straight days and you take a couple of days off and likely meet the next week, and you're talking about the same things conceptually, philosophically, I think that is a reason to be optimistic. And, you know, as a negotiator, I think you always have to be optimistic. You can hate the other side, but you have to know you're going to get a deal because it's your job to get a deal. And there's no option not to get a deal. You know, we talk about something called a BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. I'm not sure what either party's BATNA is in this case. In the best alternative to a negotiated agreement for management is frequently unilateral implementation of their last best offer. In this case, they're not going to do that. If they unilaterally implement, the players are going to go on strike. What is the player's best alternative to a negotiated agreement? I don't know that they have one, because there's really nothing out there other than making an agreement for them. I think from that perspective, there's going to be a deal. We have to be patient. We have to trust the parties are acting in their own best interests and not in bad faith until we have evidence of bad faith. And once we have evidence, I'm sure, you know, on Twitter, I'll say this is bad faith, or, you know, there's a concept called surface bargaining where you're pretending to bargain. You're basically moving around the deck chairs on the Titanic, but have no real intent to reach an agreement. And, you know, if management is doing that, I will call them out on that. But right now, they're modifying their proposals slowly. Their first proposal, management's first proposal, was ludicrous. It was never something that the union would ever agree to. It made no sense. They probably really didn't start thinking about reasonable proposals until that 42 days off. And they came back with something that was less unreasonable, but still had zero chance of success. The union turned around quickly and this past Monday made a proposal to move towards resolution by taking that one issue off the table. So I think, you know, as they start whittling down subjects, withdrawing bad proposals and making proposals that are on the same page, even though they're not overlapping, that shows you that they're making progress towards a deal. So I think they'll make a deal. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you when, and I can't tell you what thing is going to really push one side or another. But I think after 2020, I think the players have a lot of solidarity. I mean, management dragged its feet. It kept saying, we want fewer games, we want fewer games, we want fewer games, until it got to the point where it had as few games as they could argue was a legitimate season. And then they said, now we're going to implement fewer games. So they ran the clock out there. I don't think that, you know, we're going to end up in that type of situation in this case.
Well, you could follow Eugene on Twitter for his analysis on the conversations that are going on between the league and the Players Association at Eugene Friedman. And Eugene, this was incredibly insightful, just an awesome conversation. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Sox Machine podcast.
Thanks, Josh. I really enjoyed our conversation and I'm glad I had a chance to join.
That will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine podcast. Thanks for listening. And if you have been a longtime lurker or brand new to Sox Machine and enjoy our work, think about joining our Patreon. Our Patreon supporters get exclusive content, ad-free versions of the podcast and website, and the first opportunity to acquire our new Sox Machine swag at patreon.com/Sox Machine. I want to thank our new Patreon supporter, Hugh Harlan, and one of our oldest supporters, Kevin Shannon, who has been with us since the start of 2018. And in a few weeks, I'll be starting our MLB draft coverage with college baseball opening day coming, and our Patreon supporters get weekly reports of the top draft prospects. To get that exclusive content, again, sign up at patreon.com/Sox Machine. The Sox Machine podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball, and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening.